Case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the fourth case, Ward versus McAudrey. McAudrey. Okay, Mr. Eberhardt.
May it please the court, counsel. Your Honor, the prosecution of Jerry Ward was a prosecution of convenience. It was convenient for the trial judge to interview prospective jurors ex parte. It was convenient for the trial judge to interview one of the investigating detectives ex parte. It was convenient to review the police reports that were not in evidence ex parte. It was convenient for Detective John Somerville to concoct a story about the white fleshy material. It was convenient for the civilian witness to commit perjury. And it was convenient for the now rather infamous lab technician to testify the way that she did. I suggest to the court that all these little conveniences resulted in structural errors that denied the petitioner's constitutional rights. Before this court, I believe, are two questions for resolution. The first, whether or not these structural errors can be defaulted or procedurally defaulted for habeas purposes. And the second question, or secondary question, can or did the structural error occur here? The district court found adversely to Mr. Ward that, yes, in fact, structural errors can be procedurally defaulted. And the court based this on Edwards versus Carpenter. Obviously, the respondent state says, affirm this decision. I ask the court to consider, though, that if this decision is correct, what is the purpose of habeas review besides just taking the prior briefs, whether they be in the appellate court, the Supreme Court, or wherever, and just filing them with the habeas court? I suggest that's not the law, that's not the state of the habeas law. We don't just take the briefs from the direct appeal or maybe the post-conviction appeal given to the habeas judge. We have structural defects that are recognized on habeas review. We do an investigation for habeas review. We do a reinvestigation for habeas review because that's the state of the habeas law.
The procedural default doctrine is based on an interesting comedy. In other words, giving state courts the first opportunity to correct constitutional errors. Why is that concern any different when the alleged error is structural?
There are things that are just so basic, Your Honor, that once they're recognized, they have to be fixed. In this case, we don't have a structural, for instance, a biased judge, but we have a Brady violation. We have the perjury from the police officers. We have the perjury from the lab technician. These things aren't discovered until years or maybe even decades down the road. A problem that we have, and frankly, it didn't come to light because of the post-conviction lawyers, basically, they didn't pick up on it. The fact that a police officer is invited back into the trial judge's chambers ex parte with the police reports to discuss the case. The defendant does not have the benefit of a public trial. He doesn't have his lawyer back there. There's no questions being asked. There's no cross-examination going on. There's no public review of what's going on. And this is how the trial is held, and at this time, for this man's very life. And I suggest that that's the denial of his public trial. It takes years and, again, decades before these things come out. And even though we have the interests of comedy and federalism, there are just such basic mistakes that occur that they have to be corrected, and federal habeas law recognizes this. And while most of these errors can be put into the pigeonhole of trial error, and they have to be raised at certain times, otherwise they're going to be defaulted out. There's cases like this where they occur and they're not found out, and sometimes, like this case, because of the actions of the state, and we still don't have the photograph, which I suggest is Brady material, and we still don't have some of the fingerprints that the district court ordered to be produced and sent for the APHIS examination. To this day, we don't have this documentation because of the actions of the state, so that Ward could have these things checked. That's just the nature of the system, the way that it was, the way that it still is in some cases. With regard to the findings of the district court, basing its decision on Edwards versus Carpenter, when you look at the language cited by Judge Gettleman out of Edwards, it's just a condensed version of the language in Coleman. When you go to page 750 of the Coleman decision, it gives an expanded version when the Supreme Court talks about, in all cases in which a state prisoner has defaulted his federal claims in state court, pursuant to an independent and adequate state procedural rule, federal habeas review of the claims is barred unless the prisoner can demonstrate, and then I'll paraphrase, they talk about cause and prejudice or a fundamental miscarriage of justice. And the Supreme Court there doesn't talk anything about structural defect, but we all know that structural defect is accepted in habeas law. And I'm suggesting to the court that if the United States Supreme Court really meant in Edwards versus Carpenter to take structural defect away from habeas corpus jurisprudence, there would have been a very different decision in Edwards versus Carpenter. There would have been news reports and law review articles. We would have been inundated with a lot of writing saying, no, the real holding at Edwards versus Carpenter was habeas law has been changed. The law has been changed. Edwards versus Carpenter basically says the same thing as Coleman versus Thompson, and I suggest to the court that the law has not changed.
Yes, Mr. Everard, doesn't Edwards italicize the word any?
It does.
What do you make of that for emphasis when it speaks of for a federal habeas corpus court can act, that it, there has to be this prior review. I mean, what do you think you just threw that into it, for what it's worth?
It refers back to Coleman, where prior to the sentence that I read, the Supreme Court said, we now make it explicit, and then they go in to make the statement that they did and realize that you have Arizona versus Fulminante, where you have a laundry list of what's recognized as structural errors. And again, all I can say to your honors is, if we were going to take structural error and defect away from being remedies, even in habeas cases, the Supreme Court would have been much more explicit.
Well, and if we're not to do that, how did this get to be structural? How does the integrity of the process get compromised?
One example,
along with the list that we've traditionally come to recognize as structural, you know, the four or five that are so horrendous.
One example that, in this case, the attorney or the respondent recognizes that the denial of a public trial, in their briefs they say denial of a public trial is listed in Arizona versus Fulminante as a structural error. Well, they have a problem with this ex parte questioning of the police officer. They kind of slough that up. Well, that's just an ex parte discussion with the police officer. I think anybody that's done a trial in a court is going to say, wait a minute, if I'm on the opposing side...
No question, but would we then draw from that any erroneous ex parte communication by an unbiased jurist, we don't have a claim of a biased jurist, would constitute structural error on its face?
Right. I'm not talking jurors or the question of the potential jurors. I'm talking the police officer.
Or even a witness. I mean,
That's why I suggest to the court judge that you have this spectrum, and I've cited some cases in my brief, that different things may or may not in different situations rise to the level of structural error. It's not just black and white. In the law, we talk of shades of gray. Right. Some things may be structural at certain times, and it may not be structural at other times. Mm-hmm. In Ward's case, in this one particular instance, you had an investigating police officer going in with the police reports. We know the police reports are not evidence. The judge shouldn't be reading the police reports. He shouldn't be talking to the officer, giving the officer's one-sided version to the judge, and then the judge decided, well, I've talked to the police officer, I've got a vacation next week, I don't need to grant a continuance because I want to make sure I get off to my vacation, so I don't have to worry about granting a continuance award to get his witnesses in. I suggest that that's structural in this case. He was entitled to relief, and I ask that Your Honors reverse the district court.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Mahoney?
Good morning. Janet Mahoney from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office on behalf of the respondent. The only issue before this court, pursuant to the order issuing the Certificate of Appealability, is whether Edwards v. Carpenter requires the petitioner to establish cause and prejudice or a fundamental miscarriage of justice when claiming his rights were violated by ex parte communications, perjured testimony, and Brady violations, and whether they are structural errors or not. The United States Supreme Court has answered this question clearly, and I quote from that court, "We require a prisoner to demonstrate cause for his state of court default of any federal claim and prejudice therefrom before the federal habeas court will consider the merits of that claim." It goes on to say the one exception to that rule, not at issue here, is a circumstance in which the habeas petitioner can demonstrate a sufficient probability that our failure to review his federal claim will result in a fundamental miscarriage of justice. If the United States Supreme Court intended to have other exceptions, they would have included it with the exception that they listed. Therefore, structural defect claims are subject to a cause and prejudice analysis. It doesn't mean that they're not considered, but they're subject to the analysis, and it goes in the calculation of whether there's cause and prejudice to bypass the state court default. That was not done here in this case, and the district court found that because they did not go through the cause and prejudice analysis, those issues were defaulted. Again, you make also a very good point about whether these issues are even structural defects. None of them are. With regards to the ex parte communication with the police officer, this was happening during a consideration on a motion to continue. 5 days into the trial, the petitioner said, "I need time to find my witnesses. I need a continuous." The state chimed in and said, "None of these witnesses can help this defendant. There's support for our position here." And the judge said, "I'm going to consider that." And he went back and started looking at the police report. And lo and behold, through the courtroom comes one of the police officers. So he decides to talk to him solely on the issue of whether he should grant the motion to continue or not, so that he could make the proper determination on the motion to continue whether this defendant would be prejudiced by the lack of these witnesses. And the court made that determination, and I believe also there isn't any law stating that a petitioner is entitled to be present during a judge's determination as to whether a motion to continue should be granted or not. With regard to the merits of the underlying issues, it's the respondent's petition that those are beyond the order of the Certificate of Appealability, that this court is not required and should not consider those issues. And unless you have any questions regarding...
You're claiming that the ex parte conversation with the jurors is beyond the Certificate of Appealability?
Correct. The sole issue in the order was whether structural defect or the underlying claim of ex parte communication, Brady issues, and perjured testimony are subject to cause and prejudice analysis. Everything else is beyond that order and is not required by this court to be considered. Unless this court has any questions concerning those underlying issues, the respondent requests that you affirm the conviction and sentence.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mahoney. Mr. Ebert. All right. Thank you. Mr. Everett, you were appointed in this case. And in addition to the thanks we give all counsel, I want to give you an additional thanks for so ably representing the appellant in this case and accepting the appointment. The case is taken under advisement, and the